I've had a lot of coffee, and this one stands out. It's called Larry's Coffee. It has this really cute vibe to it, first of all. I've been drinking it in the mornings, and it's noticeably smoother. My favorite blend is Bean Martin. It just tasted so good. I immediately went and got a second cup of coffee. I just love the rich, dark flavor. It's got a little cartoon character on the bag, and he is drinking coffee, and he also has a martini because it's probably an espresso martini because, you know, he's Bean Martin. They have light, medium, dark roast, espresso, decaf. Larry's Coffee is independent, family-owned and operated, roasted in Raleigh, North Carolina for over 30 years. You can try this wonderful coffee and support the BGS Podcast Network at larryscoffee.com/BGS. Listeners of the BGS Podcast Network get a free gift with purchase when they purchase through that show link. And again, that's larryscoffee.com/BGS. Thanks for listening to the BGS Podcast Network. If you're interested in diving deeper into the world of roots music, Americana, and beyond, be sure to explore more from The Bluegrass Situation. Visit thebluegrasssituation.com to browse the latest editorials. And don't forget to subscribe to our weekly newsletter for new releases, exclusive content, video sessions, and more delivered straight to your inbox. Sign up at thebluegrasssituation.com/newsletter.
Last year, in 2025, I found myself driving my big gray van on a Louisiana highway again. I was west of Lake Pontchartrain. This was my Finding Lucinda film release tour. For 6 weeks, I was going crisscross around America. I drove from region to region, town to town. San Francisco to Montana, to Ann Arbor, to New Orleans, to New York and Boston. At each performance, I played Lucinda songs with musical guests, and then I screened the film. In Louisiana, I was turning left in a town called Eunice. The sun was tired of the day and had finally gone beyond the horizon, yet its pink still hung around. The corrugated metal of the gas station roof at the left edge of my turn had the quality of a blush. As I drove along, I knew for certain, like something was going to have to change. I needed to shift. I had sunk 6 good years into this project. The fruits of my labor were ripening. I held very tight to this story that I had because it worked. In many ways, it worked better than so many other projects I had done before. Some of the nights along the tour were perfect. Like in Chicago, I was in a velvety dark, very cool venue, vintage and mid-century. The audience brought their electricity, their excitement about being there. They hung on to every word. The other performers that night sang Lucinda songs in their own textured, beautiful voices and brought new insights to the songs. Along this trip, I had all of these chances to perform music in front of dozens of people, sometimes even hundreds. I got to speak on subjects that I cared about: songwriting, Lucinda's upbringing, how to confront self-doubt. Yet, as I traveled around, I felt more and more confined, like I was getting caught up in her life. This movie, this podcast, this music, this project, it was all becoming like one of the plants I saw on my drive through Louisiana, the kudzu vine. The bright green leaves, the rubbery stems were climbing up my legs, circling my arms, holding me tighter and tighter. The tendrils clung and dragged me towards this one patch of red clay in the Louisiana sun. You are listening to Finding Lucinda from The Bluegrass Situation. I'm Ismay, aka Avery. This is the final episode of season one, an epilogue, a new chapter. A year or so before I released the documentary film Finding Lucinda, I got an email that made my heart do a double jump. The subject read, "Bassist, during the entire making of Car Wheels." The body of the message said, "Hello. I want to know if I can see Finding Lucinda in Florida. I'm living in Sarasota now, but was the bassist during the entire making and touring of Car Wheels on a gravel road. I probably should have been interviewed during the making of the film, but would like to see it or speak with the filmmaker. Thanks, Richard Ombre Price." I knew about this guy. Richard had performed in what I considered to be the best Lucinda Williams live performance. In 1998, she and her band played Car Wheels on a Gravel Road at Austin City Limits. So I decided to respond. I gave Richard Ombre Price a call. At the time, I really, really thought that I had completely finished my interviews for the project. But given this unusual opportunity, I made an exception. I rung him from my cell and let him know that I wanted to interview him in person. Richard said that he was in poor health. He was undergoing treatment for cancer. He couldn't travel, so I would need to come to him in Sarasota, Florida. So, in 2025, I left a show in Bozeman, Montana, with 8 days to get to the next event in New Orleans. I sped through the high winds of Wyoming, past the drying lakes of Arkansas, and skirted around New Orleans to get to Richard in Sarasota, Florida. The conversation I had with Richard that day churned up his memories from almost 30 years prior. He described his friendship with Lucinda, revealing things about her current state as well as his. The city of Sarasota sits more than halfway down Florida's long left coast. I had to drive late into the night to get down there between shows on my tour. I decided to camp at a convenient roadside RV park about an hour north of where Richard lived. I arrived to the small pull-through site in the grass for late arrivals. I didn't get the bathroom code. All around me as I fell asleep were dozens of RVs and trailers. They were so silent and so still, it felt as if I was completely alone. The next day, I pulled into the area of Sarasota where Richard lived. His home was on a side road, just wide enough for 1.5 cars, where there was nobody walking around. In front of Richard's house was a manicured, short, green lawn. It met with the pavement at an uneven edge, almost like it was starting to take it over. Along his driveway were two small palm trees. The yard was neat, and the house was small. It was one story with red shutters, no garage. There was just a single car parked out front, a newish maroon-colored one. Richard's roommates met me and offered me a glass of water in the kitchen. They told me that that waddling pit bull wandering around the house was actually a very special and rare color, lilac. Before I met Richard, I looked at his website. On there were dozens of photos, many with different celebrities. Bill Murray, Lucinda Williams, of course, Dwayne Allman, Tom Petty. Richard got his start in Florida, playing in popular bands. He had a neighborhood jam where members of the Allman Brothers Band joined in before they were even a thing. In these photos I saw of Richard on his website, he had a soul patch, a little triangle of hair beneath his bottom lip. On his head was often a backwards baseball cap covering his dark brown curls. Richard had a strong, square face, and in each photo, he looked straight into the camera. The cancer treatment that he underwent and the years had certainly changed Richard. They watered down his voice. They narrowed his face. He was more fragile than he had been in the photos. But yet, Richard still had an iron presence. Each memory emerged from him like a totem. And Richard was solid, as bass players need to be. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Let's do a little bit of a test. Just tell me what you had to eat today.
I had liquid food because of the medical journey I've been on.
We squeezed into Richard's small room and sat on adjustable office chairs. He had an extra large computer monitor and a tall bed. He had many hard drives and CDs. All over the walls were framed photographs, mementos, gold records, all of his memories from a lifetime as a touring and recording musician.
So you guys made Car Wheels on a Gravel Road. You helped record it. We have this record up here, a gold record. It says Gold Sales Award, Lucinda Williams, Car Wheels on a Gravel Road, presented to Richard Ombre Price to commemorate RIAA certified gold sales of more than 500,000 copies of the Mercury Records album, cassette and CD, Car Wheels on a Gravel Road. I would love it if we could look at some pictures and videos that you have that I haven't seen before.
There's Tiny's. The boot store is hilarious because Lucinda's being herself and so is the boot store lady. Lucinda wanted to go. We gotta go to Tiny's.
Richard played his home video for me. The visuals were vibrant, yet they were also a bit mealy looking, as it goes with camcorder footage from the late 90s. In the video, I saw Lucinda with a group of musicians, her band, in Austin, Texas. They were at Tiny's Western Shop. The room had a low roof and rows of boots in brown, black, blue, and red leather. The band was on a break between shows. Lucinda was just chit-chatting. The owner of the store, who she spoke to, was named Tiny. And she spoke in short sentences at first, reserved, typical of a store owner. Tiny looked to be about 65 or 70. She was a native Texan with a dense accent. And Lucinda, wandering around the store casually, in her 40s at the height of her career. Lucinda asked Tiny, "Did you get a copy of Car Wheels on a Gravel Road yet?" Lucinda went on to say she was in Austin to perform for a blues historian. Then she said, "The thing is, I got this damn cold on the way here, and I practically lost my voice. I barely made it. I had to cut my set short. They're trying to get me to do all this other stuff this week. I'm supposed to be off. This is my time off. I came to do this one thing, and now I'm exhausted and strained my voice." The conversation was lighthearted between Lucinda and Tiny. Just chit-chat. Lucinda almost seemed to be enjoying her complaints. After all, she was wanted as an artist, needed, even if that meant people might ask too much of her.
Well, let's see. we did this TV show, VH1 Hard Route, and we did one with Emmy Lou in Nashville with Ron Sexsmith. We did Letterman, Saturday Night Live, Rosie O'Donnell.
I liked hanging out there in that room with Richard. He was funny and direct. I could understand why he succeeded as a touring musician. He was enjoyable to be around, and that's about half of the job. It was like he just needed someone to share this story with, someone who would stitch him into this history where he belonged. Richard then scrolled to a different home video, footage of the full band. It was a fundraiser in a club. Back when Lucinda's former drummer passed away, a group got together in Austin to raise money for his widow. There, with the bouncing bass beat, up on the stage, one of the bandmates wore a shirt with flames on the sleeves. Next was footage of the backstage of that show. There in the green room, the band talked about South by Southwest. And in that green room was a photograph. It's one that I talked about on a previous episode. It showed Lucinda in the 1970s, busking on the street. Then, the next video, the band backstage at Hard Rock Cafe.
Yeah, this was a good show, too. Anyway, you don't want to hear full long shows. That picture up there is backstage when we were on tour with Dylan and Van Morrison. Sitting on the couch in the dressing room. That was a great tour. I mean, there's a lot more I could say. Maybe over time I'll send you more stuff, but we can talk more. I'll just say my whole journey with her was a great journey. And now she's stuck with her guns and has got all this great stuff she's put out and probably going to be more before she can't sing or whatever at all. And then even if that happens, I hope she'd write short stories like she told me she was going to do. Yeah, I mean, it was like something she really was into. And said, I think I'm going to just quit singing eventually because I'm too old. I'll just sit down and write little short stories and stuff. And I thought, well, that'd be cool to have a little book of short stories, you know, about her. So, you know, when she hurt herself, she had a stroke. That scared her pretty bad, because she couldn't use her hands to play. I mean, spiritually, it hit her pretty hard. We still talk. I mean, once in a while on the phone, we text 2 times a year. And we still are pretty honest about stuff. She'll ask me stuff, you know. In that sense that we'd both been hit pretty hard out of nowhere medically, it was good to be able to just talk about it because you feel like somebody besides yourself trying to help keep your chin up during that time. She has wrestled with the faith, so to speak, the faith that was in the family and her friends, and the faith that she's also always been a little shaky about, or this and that, different beliefs. And when she hurt herself and she was facing never playing a guitar again, for her not be able to play guitar working on a song was a major blow to herself, because that's a major part of herself, a guitar and a pen. I could tell one night when she called me, she started talking about, you know, this thing called miracles, you know, we all wonder if they're real, historically. Are they true for some people and not for others? All those questions we all do. If she got her spirituality right, then maybe a healing might happen for her hands. And she was asking me my theological view on some of that stuff. And so we got into that subject a little bit. And one thing when that comes up, it's like, well, you know, if there is this supreme being and there is this gigantic purpose going on that we're all in, whether we like it or not, you could ask Jesus the same question. How come you healed that guy but she didn't heal that guy? How many hundreds of, maybe thousands of people did he walk past or see sitting out there while he was teaching and would only heal certain individuals but not everybody else? And I personally believe they exist and they happen. They're not common. And nobody gets to decide but the being itself. Jesus didn't do that for everybody in his day either, so that's spiritual food for thought.
You and I obviously will stay in touch, and you can always share anything you want with me, but for the purposes of what you were sharing with me today, is there anything else you want to share?
Well, it's hard to pick because there's still so much in my head, but that was a lot of use.
My interview with Richard made me think about how, in many ways, we don't get to choose whether we get sick, whether we heal, how high we fly, and whether it meets our expectations, whether the public loves us, whether it hates us, or whether it ignores us as artists altogether. Everyone is dealt a hand. And the challenge is how to make sense of that, to make peace with our place, make the most out of our own destinies, and to know when to let go. My afternoon with Richard would be the final interview I would conduct for Finding Lucinda. I wanted to start to untangle myself. I loved hearing the excursions into memory from people like Richard, but it got to the point where I could see her story was not my story. It never would be. And in addition, there were other malignancies I faced because of this project. I tried as much as I could to be honest about my struggles, my sense of self-doubt. I hoped to be a vehicle through which the audience could address their fears and doubts. I wanted to allow people to get to making and sharing their art. I knelt down in the dirt to tell my story, and I told my emotional truth. But I encountered something that I had not anticipated, that creating and sharing my story would open a new creative wound. I found that this story made some people feel disappointed and even angry. My emotional journey took up too much room in their mind. They said that I should just talk about her, bow down to her all-encompassingness, and their criticism played into my greatest fear of not being wanted as myself. It was like I was the opening band, and people were booing, asking me to get off the stage so they could hear the headliner. All of my struggles with other people's expectations and reactions made me think about what Charlie Sexton told me in our interview. Years earlier, he shared a concept that I did not really grasp at the time.
Then after that, I was like, you know, it's the thing. When you, that so easily, I think now more than ever, gets lost on people, that what it takes for any artist, anyone doing something that they believe in, that it's attached to film, painting, song, what it takes to actually achieve that thing, that costs something to that person. You know what I mean?
The creator of that.
That's the thing.
The kudzu vine circled my torso and was climbing up towards my collarbone. I had to find a way to cut myself free from this particular story, Finding Lucinda. Even though it worked, even though it gave me some of the validation that I wanted so badly, even though I knew there was more juice to squeeze out of this lemon. And also, I started to worry that this project was not representative of what I believed in as an artist. I loved her music, but I never wanted to support a vision of a single great songwriter. I told my story in addition to hers because I believe in the creative journey of all people, all human beings. I don't believe there are 20 great musicians we should all spend our entire lives paying homage to. And I started to worry that holding on to this project would mean I was spending my time reinforcing a noxious idea. In my journey, I realized I subconsciously believed that I had to climb a bunch of levels to get to the top in order to feel good about myself. But that wasn't right. Thinking of making music as a series of levels would mean I was getting it all wrong. That is what Mary Gaucher told me at the Station Inn.
You were saying how, you know, when you're starting a songwriter like myself, it's you kind of have these goals in mind. You kind of want to achieve something. You want to be accepted. You want people to go to your shows. You want to be relevant. But then you were saying when that happens, it's not what you think it's going to be.
That's correct.
How is it different than you thought it would be?
Because as soon as you get there, you got to go somewhere else. You can't hang around there very long. People like ask me, why don't you write another song like Mercy Now? Like, well, no, I wrote Mercy Now. Now I've got to go and do what I have to do now. I think that there's this misconception in our business where we think that there's levels and you want to get to the next level. How many times have you heard people say, I want to get to that next level? Where what happens? What, where there's all puppies and butterflies and $100 bills? There are no levels. There's only the blank page, and we are asked to look at that blank page. And as soon as we fill it up, we got to pull out another blank page. There's intrinsic discomfort in this job.
The subconscious fixation I'd had on getting to another level, it was destroying my own love of music. Picking up a guitar at home or standing in front of a microphone on stage became painful. I began to envy those that didn't pursue music as a profession because at least they could have a good relationship with this art form, one that wasn't so loaded. The truth is, I became a bit lost to myself. Seeking extrinsic rather than intrinsic worth in art, it just wasn't working. I wanted to fall in love with playing music again, to stop worrying about levels and being less than somebody else. When I was in Louisiana, I encountered a doorway to another possibility. Outside of the town of Eunice, I stopped by a music camp that my friend invited me to. It was called Black Pot, a yearly gathering of folk musicians along Fred Bella Lake. The event focused on Creole and Cajun music. And that evening, when I stopped by, I heard zydeco music ringing out from the barn. Accordion and washboard and a voice singing traditional songs. And of course, people dancing. That was something I didn't really do all that often. I think as musicians, we get into it because we love playing music and we want to do it more and more. But oftentimes we also want so badly to have this core, valuable human experience, belonging. Yet it evades us as we seek validation awards large audiences. The joy of the music that brought us in fades into the background. We worry about being left out, about comments, about not being liked, about making mistakes. Recently, I encountered something that excited me, a feeling that I haven't had in a while. Something that made me excited to dive in deep and learn more. old field recordings from the American Folklife Center's collection. For the first time in my 15 years being a folk musician, I realized that I could go back to the beginning. Back to the old songs that were developed over hundreds or even thousands of years. Maybe there's more to discover of my own humanity in this music, and there's more to create from it. There's something about collaborating with history and with others, of bringing my own individuality, but realizing I'm part of something larger that's hopeful to me. I'm not totally sure of what the next chapter of this project will hold, where exactly it's going to go. But I would like to find a way to talk about pursuing music in a way that feels healing for the creative wounds I've encountered now. I want to see if I can rediscover the intrinsic joy in playing music. The next season is going to be called Finding... I'm not sure yet. This has been Finding Lucinda with Ismay and the Bluegrass Situation. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned for the next chapter.